I'm Victor Agreta from WUOT News. This is Dialogue. In a well-intentioned move to curb drug crime, lawmakers in the 80s and 90s implemented a raft of legislation that required judges to impose mandatory minimum sentences for some crimes. Today, those laws are under scrutiny as jail populations have soared in a generation. Today on Dialogue, we'll look at the push for sentencing reform, why it's an issue, and who is involved, plus what can be done with a system that can be difficult to change. Our guests include Jeremy Faison, a Republican member of the Tennessee House of Representatives for the 11th District, and Molly Gill, Vice President of Policy for Families Against Mandatory Minimums in Washington, D.C. Join us for Dialogue after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. A New York congressman was arrested this morning on charges related to insider trading. NPR's Scott Horsley reports Representative Chris Collins is accused of passing non-public information to his son, who used it to avoid big stock losses.
Congressman Collins serves on the board of an Australian biotech company, which saw its stock price drop dramatically last summer after one of the company's drugs failed a key clinical trial. According to a federal indictment, Collins got advance warning of the trial's results and shared the news with his son. Cameron Collins and others then used that information to make timely stock trades, avoiding losses of hundreds of thousands of dollars. The congressman himself is not accused of trading stock, but he is charged with conspiracy, fraud, and lying to investigators. Collins' attorneys deny any wrongdoing and promise to mount a vigorous defense to clear the Buffalo area lawmaker's good name. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
The race for Ohio's 12th congressional district is still too close to call. At this point, Republican Troy Balderson is leading Democrat Danny O'Connor by about 1,700 votes. But another 8,000 provisional and absentee ballots are still to be counted. The House seat has been in Republican hands for more than 30 years. Four states held primaries yesterday. NPR's Jessica Taylor reports some highly touted progressive candidates were unsuccessful in Democratic races.
In the Michigan primary for governor, both Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and New York Democratic congressional nominee Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez had endorsed Abdul El-Sayed, a former Detroit health commissioner. But he lost to Senate Minority Leader Gretchen Whitmer, who is backed by many in the Democratic establishment and the women's group Emily's List. Whitmer will now face the state's Republican Attorney General Bill Schuette, who was endorsed by President Trump in his primary. Ocasio-Cortez rose to fame after she knocked off the number 4 House Democrat in her primary in June. She also endorsed a challenger in Missouri to longtime Democratic Congressman William Lacey Clay, but the incumbent easily hung on. Jessica Taylor, NPR News, Washington.
In Kansas, the Republican primary for governor is still too close to call. Secretary of State Kris Kobach is leading the incumbent governor, Jeff Collier, by fewer than 200 votes, but absentee ballots are still being counted. California firefighters report progress in containing the largest fire in state history. Officials say the Mendocino Complex fire north of San Francisco is now about 47% contained. Will Powers is CAL FIRE's public information officer. He says it's been a challenge.
They're using a lot of helicopters and aircraft to go up there and, you know, put out those hot spots, put out some of that really hot areas, and then also dropping down retardant lines to slow that fire down in some of those areas.
The fire has burned about 300,000 acres, almost the size of Los Angeles. On Wall Street, the Dow is down 56 points. The S&P is down 1. This is NPR News. Residents of the Indonesian island of Lombok are struggling to recover from Sunday's earthquake. Most of the island is still without power and clean water is in short supply. Thousands of people are homeless. The quake measured 6.9. Officials put the death toll at 131, but warned that number could rise as rescue workers search through the rubble. Senior British Conservative lawmaker Boris Johnson is being sharply criticized for making what are being interpreted as derogatory remarks about Muslim women who wear the full-face veil or burqa. Larry Miller reports that Johnson, a former foreign secretary and London mayor, is refusing to apologize.
In his newspaper column, Johnson defends the right of Muslim women to wear what they want, including the face-covering burqa. But he writes, it's ridiculous. People should choose to go around looking like bank robbers, and mailboxes. There are calls for him to be kicked out of the Conservatives, even from within his own party. Johnson was a leader of the Brexit campaign in which immigration was a key issue. He's also seen as a possible future prime minister. A Conservative member of the House of Lords accuses Johnson of using Muslim women as a political football to increase his poll ratings. Prime Minister Theresa May insists Johnson must apologize. There's no indication he plans to. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
Thailand is granting citizenship to three boys and their coach who are part of a soccer team trapped in an underground cave. The four have been stateless, which had deprived them of some basic benefits. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Express, proud supporter of the How I Built This Summit, taking place in San Francisco at the Yerba Buena Center on October 16th. Learn more about the summit at npr.org/summit.
It's 6 minutes after 12 o'clock. You're listening to Dialogue on your public radio station, 91.9 FM WUOT.
Support for WUOT comes from Centro Hispano de East Tennessee, presenting the Latino Awards Gala, recognizing achievements and those supporting East Tennessee's Hispanic population, August 23rd at the Mill and Mine. More at centrohispanotn.org.
And you are listening to Dialogue on WUOT. I'm your host, Victor Agreta. We are joined today with Molly Gill, Vice President of Policy for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Molly, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
And just one programming note, Jeremy Faison was going to join us. He's a Tennessee State Representative for the 11th District. He had a family situation and is not going to be able to make it to us today, but we will carry on and we will talk about this because this is a huge topic. And Molly, just to give our listeners a little bit of background, what brought you to Families Against Mandatory Minimums?
Well, I started off actually very early in my legal career working in a prosecutor's office and putting a lot of people in prison, some of whom were truly frightening and dangerous people who I thought needed to be in prison, and some of whom weren't those kinds of people. And I kind of questioned why we were putting them in prison and how that was making us safer, and that was also when I had my first exposure to mandatory minimum sentences, which are penalties attached to certain kinds of crimes, and if that crime is charged, the mandatory sentence applies, and there's really very little the judge can do about it. And so I saw judges having to give people mandatory minimum sentences, even if the judge thought that that sentence didn't really fit that person or the crime. Even if, the prosecutor and the jury thought that that sentence didn't really fit that crime. And I didn't think that was particularly fair or a good use of public safety resources, and I decided I wanted to try to reform that aspect of the system. So I came to FAM in 2007. FAM has been around for 27 years. We're a nonprofit, we're a nonpartisan, and we work to reform sentencing laws, to make prison systems more rehabilitative, and also to make sure people are getting things like clemency and compassionate release, which are release mechanisms for people who've shown extraordinary rehabilitation, or in the case of compassionate release, for people who are elderly or terminally ill.
And I think it's important to drill down a little bit, too, into mandatory minimums because, you know, we say this, that the judge doesn't have, say, leeway in sentencing. But it's not just that. It's also there are parameters that are specified in the sentence. So, say, parole is dictated. You can't be paroled until a certain time. Is that correct?
Yeah, these things can vary a little bit from state to state. But I would call a mandatory sentence either a prescribed sentence that the judge can't grant probation or another form of punishment. So, mandatory minimum 5 years in prison. And then also, limits on parole eligibility. So if you have a mandatory sentence you can't get parole until a certain period of time, that's also a mandatory minimum.
And something that I've found in my research is that a lot of former prosecutors, some former judges, of course, have come out against these mandatory minimums. We had a few months ago, we had an interview with someone who had actually stepped down from a federal judgeship who was appointed by President Obama because he felt that these were unfair. And of course, as a judge, he wasn't able to do much within that constraint. And so that's why he sort of said, well, you know what, I'm going to leave this position and hopefully work to effect change. What I'm curious about here is what are some of the ancillary effects of mandatory? I mean, you know, we're talking about someone's liberty. We're talking about putting someone in jail for a prescribed amount of time, no matter what the extenuating circumstances. But what is the sort of ancillary effects that that has on their family and on the community?
Yeah, I mean, apart from just being, in some cases, a horrible injustice of receiving a punishment that does not fit your crime or your personal circumstances, which I think every person who walks into a courtroom in America expects that sort of basic individual treatment, that the judge will look at them and look at their facts and circumstances and the role that they played in the crime, and that the judge will pick a sentence that fits those things. And so that is a horrible injustice, being denied that treatment and in many cases receiving a sentence that is just far out of proportion to what you may have done. You know, FAM has never believed that we shouldn't punish crime, and we're not against prisons. We just think the punishment needs to fit the crime. But the other effects of having a mandatory prison sentence, obviously it's incredibly difficult for families to get through a mandatory prison sentence, especially a lengthy one. It's hard to keep a marriage going when one partner is incarcerated. So it's hard on marriages, and that obviously divorce can be a big destabilizing factor in a family life. It's hard on children as well. It can be very hard to maintain relationships with children, especially if you're incarcerated far away from them and they don't have the means to visit you frequently. And so it's, you know, children often are growing up without parents, and spouses become single parents and single, you know, family breadwinners, and that creates emotional strain, economic strain, strained relationships, and often, you know, trauma that can persist throughout not just the incarcerated person's life, but the lives of every member of his family, too.
And I'm curious, how did we get here? I mean, when did this begin? You mentioned that FAM is almost 30 years old. So how far back does this go?
The real mandatory minimum sentencing boom in the United States started in the 1980s and really was the result of a short period of time where crime was very high and drug use was growing, and particularly the use of crack cocaine, which was a new and very frightening drug. And Congress, you know, created a whole slew of mandatory minimum sentences for drug crimes. Most of the states followed suit, and it kind of became the popular thing to do. It was an easy way as a lawmaker to say, I'm tough on crime. Look, I'm trying to solve these drug problems in our communities. We'll just crack down on these drug dealers, and this problem will be solved. And the impact of that we see 30 years later. 30 years later, we have the world's biggest prison population. We spend an enormous amount of money on this population. It impacts more than 2.3 million people and their families in this country on any given day. And we still have drug problems in America. Right now, we are in the midst of an opioid crisis. And lawmakers, fortunately, this time around, I think, have learned a little bit from the 1980s. And we're seeing some pushes for mandatory sentences for opioids, but more talk about let's try to increase treatment in the community. Let's try to get smarter about, you know, how we're solving this addiction problem and what's driving these addiction problems. So I would say we've made some progress, but we still have a ways to go.
Well, I can tell you that here in East Tennessee, and particularly in Knox County, we have seen definitely a push by some to have more rehabilitation, more treatment centers and whatnot. So I do feel like there's a little bit of progress on that end. I want to turn to a specific case here that's mentioned on your website of Calvin Bryant. He's serving 17 years for a first-time offense, and his sentence was enhanced by Tennessee's drug-free school zone law. So what can you tell us about these drug-free school zone laws?
Yeah, these are other relics of the 1980s and 1990s. And, you know, the intent behind the law, I think, is perfectly understandable and even, you know, praiseworthy. Obviously, no one wants their children to be surrounded by drug activity while they're at school. And that's fair, and I would want that, and I think most people want that. The problem is that these laws, which were created in many states, not just Tennessee, are often so broad that they turn entire cities sometimes into school zones. So in Tennessee, the school zone is 1,000 feet from any school, library, public park, swimming pools. So when you start daycare centers, rec centers, so when you start looking at all the things that count as a school zone and then drawing 1,000-foot radiuses around these school zones, you start covering huge parts of cities. And we see that in Tennessee. In Tennessee, 27% of Nashville is considered a school zone. 38% of Memphis is considered a school zone. And there are more than 8,000 school zones in the entire state of Tennessee with these that are these prohibited areas. And the problem there is that, you know, 1,000 feet, number one, is quite far from a school. And number two, in urban areas especially, schools might be surrounded with apartments, gas stations, 7-Elevens, shopping malls, other places that people may go to sell drugs, and they're not selling to children, they're not targeting children, but simply because the crime happens in that special 1,000-foot zone, they get a much, much, much longer sentence. And that's what happened to Calvin Bryant.
Yeah, it was he is, I believe, 31 years old now. He was, I think, 18 when he was convicted. And it looks like the sentence would have been like less than 3 years, but because it was in this drug-free zone, he got a much harsher sentence. I mean, do you find that pretty much across the country? Is this something that is there a state that has sort of reversed this trend, or is it still pervasive?
Yeah, several states have reformed this, and I'd say more are doing so, and realizing sort of the flaws and unintended consequences of these laws. New Jersey has done a good school zone reform. Massachusetts has done a good one. I would say Utah maybe is the gold standard. Just recently, Utah narrowed the definition of a school zone to 100 feet within the real property of a school. So it has to be school, and then essentially 100 feet perimeter around that is a school zone. So it's a nice, tight area. And also, the school zone law only applies during school activity hours, which they define from about 6:30, I think, until 10 o'clock at night. And so, again, you're really targeting with that nice, tight law, you're targeting people who are selling very close to school property during school hours when there are likely to be children around. And people who aren't, you know, maybe are within 99 feet and at, you know, midnight selling drugs to another adult, those people are not going to get the school zone enhanced penalty. And I think that's a very smart move. I think Utah is you know, really being focused there, and that's a standard other states should look at.
Well, on the other side of this break, we're going to talk just a minute more about Calvin. We're going to talk about some other things, and we're also going to take your calls, those of you who are listening in. We'll be back in just a moment.
Brian Brown fled his California home when fire threatened.
A police officer pulls down there. He then yells at us, "Get out now!" And there's three helicopters right above our house, ready to drop water.
I'm Ari Shapiro. With record-setting wildfires in California, we'll ask, is there a better way to fight them? Weighing the options for fighting fires this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Tune in today at 4 on WUOT.
Support for WUOT comes from German Saturday School of Knoxville, a Saturday morning language school teaching German to all ages and levels. Classes start September 8th. Registration at 694-3765 or germansaturdayschool.org.
Support for WUOT comes from Knoxville Executive Suites, offering conference rooms that can be rented hourly, for half a day, or a full day. Near Cedar Bluff and I-40, details at kesinc.com.
It's 19 minutes after 12 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon, August 8th. You're listening to Dialogue on your public radio station, 91.9 FM, WUOT. Mostly cloudy skies are in the forecast today with a 60% chance of late afternoon showers and thunderstorms. Highs today around 87.
And this is Dialogue. We are talking about sentencing reform and some judicial reforms. A lot of this goes back to mandatory minimums. And just before the break, we were talking about Calvin Bryant, a Tennessee resident who is serving 17 years for a first-time offense. And I'm particularly struck by the words of the assistant district attorney who prosecuted Calvin. He later said, "I would personally not oppose a clemency or early release petition by him, given the long term of incarceration he's already served and the nonviolent nature of the offenses for which he was convicted." And my guest is Molly Gill, Vice President of Policy for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. If you want to call in and ask questions of Molly or myself, you can call us at 974-5050. You can also tweet at us at WUOTFM. And so, Molly, I want to ask you about this idea of clemency. Interestingly enough, President Trump recently granted clemency to someone because Kim Kardashian appealed on her behalf, and he's indicated that he might want to do more of that. But what about governors? How many governors have granted clemency in cases like this, where you have mandatory minimums and maybe something that's just egregiously, serving a longer sentence than they would have?
Yeah, we've seen a handful of governors do this. It's a power that almost all governors have and that unfortunately is just not used enough. There are plenty of unjust cases, but oftentimes governors see granting clemency as a political hazard, especially if you might have ambitions for higher office. And an example of this was Governor Mike Huckabee from Arkansas. He granted a lot of clemency grants, both commutations and pardons, to people that he felt were sentenced unfairly in his state. And later on, one of the men that he released, who clearly had some serious mental health issues, went on and killed four people. And that became a big headline when Mr. Huckabee was in a presidential primary. And, to his credit, Governor Huckabee stood by his grants, though, and said, "I felt it was the right thing to do and that the sentence he had received was unjust." And, I think that clemency does take political courage. It is the right thing to do, but it is not without risk. And I think that's why some governors are opposed to the idea. However, I cannot for the life of me fathom why, Governor Haslam wouldn't grant clemency to someone like Calvin Bryant. I mean, he had really no criminal record. It was a nonviolent offense. And, he has a family waiting for him on the outside and a support system. And certainly having the support of a prosecutor and a judge involved in the case, that helps too.
And what does it take for someone who's in prison to file for clemency?
Usually it's a matter of filing paperwork, often with the parole board, and they'll do a review and make a recommendation to the governor, and then the governor, has the final decision. In a lot of states, unfortunately, it's a pretty sort of futile effort. A lot of people are sort of summarily denied, and then often too, the process can take quite a long time. It's unfortunately not a top priority of a lot of administrations.
And it does seem that a lot of them wait maybe until they are sort of in the lame duck session or they're at the very end of their term. That is sort of what's happening here in Tennessee with Governor Haslam. He's weighing a few different clemency requests. One of them is a fairly high profile case, Antonia Brown, which is not a mandatory minimum, but she was definitely very young when she was sentenced. And sort of related to that point, actually, is how much does race and economic status play into this discussion?
Well, it's an undeniable fact that the criminal justice system disproportionately impacts people of color. And the reasons for that are quite complicated and come from, I think, numerous sources. poverty tends to, contribute to criminal activity, but there are also factors of policing and, certain neighborhoods being over-policed and racial profiling. And, so the reasons that, people are disproportionately impacted, I think, have multiple sources, and it's hard to point to just one thing and say that's what's causing it. What we do know also is that people of color tend to do worse at sentencing. Tennessee's drug-free school zone law is an example of that. 17% of people in Tennessee are African American, but 69% of drug-free school zone offenders are African American. It's hugely disproportionate, and some of that comes from, I think, the concentration of that law in urban areas. Some of it, though, may be because of prosecutorial charging decisions. Prosecutors ultimately are the ones who decide what a person is charged with, and they don't have to charge a person with violating the drug-free school zone law. They could choose a simple drug trafficking charge that doesn't carry that long mandatory sentence. I think the long-term effects of incarceration in these communities, which can be disadvantaged already, it just exacerbates bad circumstances there. So there's a Pew report that looked at, the economic impact of incarceration and found that sort of all people who go to prison do worse economically over the course of their lives. They found that serving time reduced hourly wages for men by about 11%. It reduced annual earnings for men by 40%. So going to prison hits the wallet, and that hits the family, and that hits the community too.
And it seems like if there is an issue of systemic racism, then this is perpetuating that same system over decades, really.
Yes, definitely. And I mean, in communities of color, where you have a large number of usually young men missing from the community, that has an impact as well. You're missing, you're taking fathers out of homes and families and communities. You're taking male role models out of communities. There are sort of social ramifications and costs of this that could be multi-generational and are very hard to quantify.
Well, in Tennessee, the 1989 Sentencing Reform Act really standardized a lot of sentences for a variety of crimes. And then in the 90s, the legislature got even stricter. And there was an interesting case here, in particular in 1995, it was sort of euphemistically titled Truth in Sentencing Laws that were passed. And in effect, you commit certain crimes on an arbitrarily composed list, regardless of past criminal history or any other mitigating factors, and you have no chance of consideration for parole. At least 85% of the sentence has to be served, regardless of sentence credits or good behavior the inmate gets. Some of this is from a 2014 blog post by someone who was incarcerated under those stringent terms. And what's troubling to me is that when this person was in court, the judge could not tell the jury what the sentence would be if found guilty of, say, voluntary manslaughter versus second-degree or first-degree murder. And I'm curious as to why that would be warranted. I mean, why would legislators pass a law that constrains a judge from even giving the jury simple facts that would seriously impact this defendant's life?
Yeah. Well, it's been a longstanding legal rule and presumption, really, that the jury decides facts and, except in a few states, really has nothing to do with the sentencing process. And the concern, I think, especially probably among prosecutors, is that if you told the jury what the sentence might be, they might not want to convict someone because they might think that that sentence, maybe a mandatory sentence, was unjust. And we actually recently saw a fairly high-profile instance of this at the federal level in the case of Frederick Turner. Frederick Turner was a first-time drug offender. He was addicted to drugs, was part of a drug conspiracy, and during the drug conspiracy basically delivered a handgun at one point from one person to another. Frederick himself, had never shot a gun, never used a gun, didn't carry a gun when he was you know, involved in drugs. He was literally just running an errand. And because of that, he received not only a mandatory minimum sentence for the drug crime, but also mandatory minimum sentences of a combined 30 years for that gun. And altogether, he got a 40-year mandatory minimum sentence for that drug offense. And the judge in this case was not happy about this. And apparently, neither was one of the jurors. And one of the jurors came forward later on and had done some research and found out what the sentence was and wrote a, you know, a piece in the was quoted in a Washington Post article saying, if I had known the sentence, I never would have, you know, voted to convict him. I think that sentence is horribly unjust. And so did Frederick Turner's judge, who is a very conservative, you know, Reagan-appointed judge, who is saying this is wrong. And so I think there is a growing discussion about that. Shouldn't juries at least be aware of what the potential punishments are when they're voting to convict?
And just a reminder to our listeners, you can get in touch with us at 974-5050. You can tweet us at WUOTFM. Now, I'm interested in this because you mentioned prosecutors, of course, have discretion. The interesting part about it is that the judges no longer have a certain amount of discretion, right? And even a jury could say, you know what, I mean, if I'm not mistaken, can't a jury say, we find them guilty maybe on the evidence, but we're going to toss this out because we're taking a moral stand here? That seems very rare, though, right?
Yeah, it's called jury nullification, and it is very rare. And I think it is what something that, that you know people fear in the criminal justice system. They do want a fact finder, you know, to find the facts and you know, just the facts, ma'am, kind of approach to criminal justice in this country. So, yeah, I mean, mandatory sentences in particular have basically transferred sentencing power from judges to prosecutors. People often think that the judge is the most powerful person in a courtroom, and they'd be wrong. The most powerful person in the courtroom is the prosecutor. The prosecutor works, number one, without any oversight. None of he can't be sued if his decisions are wrong. He has immunity from that. The prosecutor makes their decisions in secret, not in public. They decide in an office with no one sort of watching over their shoulder what to charge you with. And if they want to throw the book at you, they can, even if you don't really deserve it. And there's really nothing the judge can do about those charging decisions. And if those charges happen to carry mandatory minimum sentences, there's also nothing the judge can do about the sentence. So it's so important to do mandatory sentencing reform to balance the scales of power in the courtroom again and, you know, to make sure that prosecutors have accountability. You know, when a judge gets it wrong, we can appeal the judge's decision and a higher court can reverse him. And in places where judges are elected, if we can get rid of that judge, we can boot him out of office. That just recently happened in California. The judge in the Brock Turner rape case, he gave Brock Turner's, you know, what was considered a very light prison sentence for his offense, and they had a recall election, and that judge is gone now. But that kind of accountability doesn't exist for prosecutors at all, and that should be very frightening for people who care about separation of powers, who care about checks and balances, who care about fairness and you know, sort of even-handedness in our justice system.
In fact, to that point, I believe we have a caller on the line who has a question about that. Hello, John.
Yes, this is John Wilkins, and it puzzles me that it seems to me that what we have happening is that the prosecutors intrude on the process between the people who are the ones who are ultimately protected and the ones who, in effect, affect mercy, and this is or to affect protection, so that just the will of the people, as expressed through a jury, is and to affect justice is compromised, and in addition to that, by these draconian measures that are imposed upon the system, distorts it so that it's not possible for mercy to triumph over justice, which I think needs to take priority. Thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, John. Molly, what do you think about that?
I do agree. I think we have a merciless justice system. One could argue that it's not a justice system, because if justice is the concept of getting what you deserve, an eye for an eye, but not a leg for an eye or a life for an eye, our justice system fails as a justice system as well. But it also is incredibly merciless. And, laws like mandatory minimums and truth in sentencing laws and that deny parole to people, that's not giving people room for second chances. And people need second chances. A society where no one gets a second chance is a society like ours, where you're going to lock a lot of people up and cause a lot of collateral damage in the name of, tough law enforcement.
And also to that point, we have another caller, Jewel, and I believe she has a question about opioids. Hello, Jewel.
Hi. This is such an important conversation that you're having, and I hope that you will be made available more, or that we can maybe the community can find out how to reach you and to speak more, for there to be more awareness on the system that is not working. It's so evident with everything that you've been discussing today and revealing. And I just appreciate you and hope that I don't know if you go to Washington or if you work mostly with the state, but I do know that, change starts with awareness, and I think you're doing such a wonderful service in that manner. And the question, it wasn't really a question, but it was just a comment. You were speaking earlier about the issue of opioids and how they are just destroying so many lives, including the collateral damage of jail time and prison time and the destruction of the family. And what I just had not thought about it, but back when we became aware of the tobacco industry of adding all of these addictive chemicals that caused people that smoke to be more addicted to the product, thus increasing their health risk, it seems like, it was good that the government, finally all of that was exposed. And there were changes made. And it appears to me that the pharmaceutical companies have taken up the slack when it comes to providing products for doctors to prescribe that they know that they are going to have such a lethal effect on not only on their body, but the addiction aspect. And the fact that you brought out the treatment, that we really do need to be focused on the causes, the root causes of addiction. And nobody is looking at that, like you said. And I think you did comment that there are, more treatment centers that are coming up. But to me, that is such an obvious thing that they've left out, that they've never considered, because it all comes back to that individual and what's troubling them and where they're trying to, cushion the pain or whatever it is that they're dealing with emotionally. And so thank you so much. I appreciate you and this program.
Thank you, Jewel.
Thank you, Jewel. It's going to be really interesting to watch how reactions to the continuing opioid epidemic play out, especially in legislatures. we, like I said, we're seeing more restraint about using mandatory sentences, but we are also sort of seeing a repeat of what happened in 1986 with crack cocaine with the drug fentanyl, which is a very powerful and very fatal opioid. And a lot of states, Florida is one of the most recent examples, have passed new or tougher mandatory sentencing laws for fentanyl. And you see some of the sort of thriller headlines about, you know, police officer touches fentanyl and dies, or overdoses just from touching it. And some of this news, some of these articles are more hyperbole than fact. And so I think we're in a real transition right now in seeing how far we really are going to move away from that sort of lock 'em up approach that we took in the 1980s. And I think what I'm seeing among lawmakers is they're trying to be sort of more selective, again, focusing on fentanyl as sort of the bad, scary drug that deserves a mandatory minimum, but maybe not heroin. And they're also, some are trying to focus more resources on treatment. But I think some are also running out of patients, and they feel like the worse this problem gets and the longer it goes on and the more sad overdose stories that they read in the newspaper, the more pressure there is to, you know, quote unquote, do something. And the easiest thing for a lawmaker to do is to pass a mandatory minimum sentence. But we know that doesn't work. So I think our task as voters, as citizens, is to get educated and to contact our lawmakers when these kinds of laws come up and to say, no, we don't want you to do more of the same. More of the same is insanity, and it's not working. We want you to be innovative. We want you to put money where it matters, where it counts, where it makes a difference, and we want you to be patient and keep trying that approach.
And we're going to get back to that after this break. My guest is Molly Gill with Families Against Mandatory Minimums. We're talking about mandatory minimum sentencing, and we do have a ray of hope. We're going to talk about that after the break.
Carolina Chorvath was born in Belgium to an American mom and a Slovak dad. Her family moved between countries and cultures and languages, which made her ask, where was home?
When I moved to the United States, I think people expected me to know more and to be more prepared with American culture. And I just was not.
Growing up mobile on the world.
Tune in for the world this afternoon at 3 o'clock on WUOT2.
Support for WUOT comes from the Tennessee Department of Agriculture. County fairs are happening across the state of Tennessee and feature farm life, family fun, and competitions. County fairs are listed on picktnproducts.org and the Pick Tennessee mobile app.
It's 17 minutes before 1 o'clock. You're listening to Dialogue on this Wednesday afternoon on your public radio station, 91.9 FM WUOT. Mostly cloudy skies are in the forecast for this afternoon. A late afternoon chance of showers and thunderstorms in the forecast as well. Highs today expected near 87 degrees. And then for tonight, mostly cloudy, a chance of showers and thunderstorms, and lows around 69. You're listening to Dialogue on this Wednesday afternoon on your public radio station, 91.9 FM, WUOT.
And this is WUOT Dialogue. I am Victor Agreta. My guest today is Molly Gill, Vice President of Policy for Families Against Mandatory Minimums. And we've been talking about this. I want to ask you, Molly, and also our listeners, if you want to dial in, you can ask questions of Molly at 974-5050. You can tweet us at WUOTFM. So, Molly, was there any progress made during the Obama administration on mandatory minimums?
And maybe not quite at the federal level, although there was some important crack cocaine sentencing reform that was passed. The Fair Sentencing Act was passed and signed in 2010 by President Obama, and that sort of alleviated the way that crack powder, you know, crack cocaine sentencing happened. For a long time, there was a huge disparity between crack and powder cocaine sentencing. Essentially, it took 100 times as much powder cocaine as crack cocaine to get the same mandatory minimum sentence. This was called the 100-to-1 disparity, and it had a terrible disparate impact on communities of color, particularly African Americans, who ended up serving a lot more time for a lot less drugs. So in 2010, Congress passed and the president signed a bill that sort of narrowed that disparity. So now the weight disparity is 18-to-1. I think President Obama did a lot to help criminal justice along. There are certainly people who say he could have done more and should have done more, and I think that is there's some truth to that. He granted clemency to 1,700 people, many of whom were serving just ridiculously lengthy sentences for drug crimes. So those 1,700 people, you know, get a second chance and a fresh start, and that was obviously hugely important to them. And I think that also the conversation really changed about this in Congress during the Obama administration. The issue really became a bipartisan issue. You've seen sort of conservatives and progressives align on this and really find a lot of common ground. So I would say the Obama administration overall was pretty good to criminal justice reform.
And that's sort of what's interesting. I know the Sentencing Reform and Corrections Act also was passed in 2015. And, of course, the Justice Department was a little more dedicated to looking inward at itself. Under the Trump administration, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who this isn't the first time he's butted heads with the president, but he's talking about reopening the floodgates to federal prisons by restarting the war on drugs. He's been against reforming mandatory minimums, and yet I was a little bit surprised because we live in very polarizing times right now that the president has given very recently a thumbs up to reform during a meeting of Republican senators for a compromise proposal that would introduce several sentencing reform provisions into the First Step Act. Can you tell us about the First Step Act?
Yeah, the First Step Act is a prison reform bill. It passed out of the United States House by a huge bipartisan vote, 360-59, and as someone who lives in Washington and watches Congress quite closely, I can tell you that does not happen very much these days. So it came out of the House with a lot of support. The bill would do a couple things that are really important for federal prisons. It would provide $250 million of funding over 5 years to increase programs in prisons. A lot of people say that prison makes people worse. A lot of the federal prisoners I talk to say that federal prison makes you bored, that there just is not a lot of programming and rehabilitation in federal prisons, not a lot of job training. And prisoners want those opportunities. They want to get a skill that they can bring home so they can get a job and take care of their families. And we're failing to provide that to them in way too many cases right now. The bill also gives federal prisoners more time off each year for good behavior, which will bring them home to their families sooner. Obviously, that's incredibly appealing if you're a family member who's waiting for that loved one on the other end. And they also do things like reform the use of compassionate release for sick and elderly prisoners. Right now, sick and elderly people ask the Bureau of Prisons for a compassionate release, and many of them die before they get an answer because the process just has so much red tape. And so this bill cuts some of the red tape, speeds up the process, and really tells the Bureau of Prisons, you have to take those requests seriously, and you have to, you know, look at those requests and answer them in a reasonable amount of time. So it's the First Step Act includes all those prison reforms, but it doesn't include any sentencing reform. And that's what the president sort of just gave the thumbs up on, as you said. He said, let's add some sentencing reform to this. And so right now the bill is in the United States Senate, and we're, you know, very hopeful and urging senators to include some sentencing reforms in this bill, even if Attorney General Sessions doesn't like it.
Well, and of course, Congress just took a break for the last bit of the summer here, and I expect that they will be taking this bill up when they return. What is has Attorney General Sessions vocalized sort of what is his rationale for being in support of mandatory minimums?
His rationale is the rationale, I would say, of most prosecutors, which usually goes a little something like this. One, all of these people are really bad people. Two, if I don't have a mandatory minimum, I can't get them to plead guilty, and that means more work for me and more work for me in my office. And three, this is also a mandatory minimum. It's also the only way I can get people to give me information about other bad guys so I can go out and get them and lock them up too. And I have problems with all of those arguments because not everyone who gets a mandatory minimum deserves one, as we've been talking about for the last 40 minutes. You know, some of them don't deserve them. One size does not fit all. There are certainly bad people who get mandatory minimums, but there are some people who don't deserve those mandatory sentences. In terms of being able to sort of coerce people to plead guilty, the Constitution gives you a right to a jury trial, and we shouldn't be empowering prosecutors to take that right away from you by threatening you with such a long punishment that basically your only hope of ever seeing your family again is to plead guilty and get a shorter sentence. I think that's hugely problematic from a constitutional perspective. You know, 97% of all cases end in guilty pleas. Trials these days only happen on TV. And I think that's a problem. I don't think that's a fair justice system. When you're coercing people into giving up constitutional rights at that rate, that's a problem. And then in terms of, you know, getting cooperation to go get more bad guys, while that's all noble and, of course, we want, you know, the real bad guys off the street, again, I think that a mandatory minimum is giving a prosecutor a sledgehammer that he can use to beat people into submission. You know, what's funny, though, too, is that there are states that don't have mandatory minimums, like Texas, and Texas prosecutors still get people to plead guilty. They still get people to cooperate and turn in other bad guys, and they don't have mandatory minimums to do it. So I think those arguments don't really stand up very well.
And I would say that a fair share of the Texas legislature and, of course, the governor are at least politically aligned with Attorney General Sessions. So it is sort of an interesting case, I would say. Now, to that end, and you mentioned prosecutors have some discretion here as to what to charge people with. Have there been court challenges against mandatory minimums?
Yes. I mean, the oldest one really was an Eighth Amendment challenge that a mandatory minimum life without parole sentence was cruel and unusual punishment. This was the Harmelin versus Michigan case, and it challenged a Michigan law that required life without parole for a first-time drug offense. And the court upheld the law and said that, you know, mandatory minimums have been on the books and since the country was founded, and there's nothing sort of inherently unconstitutional about Congress creating a mandatory minimum. And since they're usual, they're regular, they're not cruel and unusual punishment, basically. And there are people who want to go back into court and test that case again and see how that case would stand up in today's environment. We're also seeing courts striking down provisions of mandatory sentencing laws that they find are overly broad and vague, and essentially saying that, you know, parts of poorly written mandatory sentencing laws are, if they're overly vague, we're going to strike down those parts of those laws, and courts don't seem afraid to do that. So I think the courts do provide another avenue to challenge these laws.
And you mentioned that Texas doesn't have mandatory minimums, but you also mentioned, I believe, that Utah is sort of leading the pack in terms of reform. What are some of the things that Utah has done?
Utah has done a couple of interesting things in recent years. They have that gold standard drug-free school zone reform that I mentioned earlier. They repealed all their mandatory sentences for drug possession, I believe, and then they defelonized drug possession so that now all drug possession offenses are a misdemeanor, which can make a really big impact. For example, if you're later on in life facing, for example, a habitual offender law, like a three strikes law, usually those three strikes laws require that your prior crimes be felonies, and if now some of your prior drug possession offenses or misdemeanors, you're not going to face that three strikes and you're outlaw, like in many states. So another state that's really been a model for this is South Carolina. South Carolina repealed almost all of its mandatory minimum drug sentences, and they want to repeal more of their mandatory sentences. And since they passed that law, the state has saved billions of dollars, they've closed prisons, and crime has continued to go down in the state. Another state that is just at the beginning of sort of this experiment is Louisiana. Last year, Louisiana repealed almost all of its mandatory minimum sentences for drug and gun possession offenses. And, you know, we're going to see, you know, sort of how the state implements that. They're already saving money. Their prison population is already going down. And so far, crime has remained relatively stable in Louisiana.
And that's speaking to the cost issue. That's something that I was curious about, too. How much of this factors into for-profit prisons?
Yeah, I think that this issue, while it's very important, is maybe a bit of a red herring. We spend about $80 billion a year as a nation on incarceration, and only about $3 or $4 billion of that goes to private prisons. So while they're not insignificant, I would say that they're not maybe sort of the big monster that a lot of people, you know, think they are either. So certainly people have strong moral objections to private prisons. Some people believe, you know, private prisons shouldn't be, people shouldn't be profiting off of the sort of pain of incarceration that people go through. There's a debate going on about whether private prisons are in fact cost effective for states and whether states actually save any money by privatizing prisons. It's an important conversation, but I'm not sure that it's quite as important in the cost factor as people think it is.
And essentially, you've not seen a sort of quid pro quo, because I think that some people think that, oh, well, you know, we have these sentences and mandatory minimums because they want to stuff the jails and give these folks money. But that's not really what's going on there, right?
I think that's pretty rare. There are some examples, you know, from about, I think, 10 years ago where private prison companies were requiring states to keep prisons at a certain level of capacity in terms of, you know, like 90% capacity. And, you know, I think that was a pretty rare situation, and that's not happening anymore. I think most of the growth happening right now in private prisons is actually with private detention of undocumented immigration law violators. And that seems to be where maybe we can expect. My guess is that's where we'll see most of the growth in the Trump administration.
Well, we've got about a minute left. Molly, briefly describe a little bit about what FAM does.
So FAM works with Congress and with state lawmakers all across the country to try to reform these mandatory sentencing laws, to increase the use of clemency and compassionate release, and to improve our prisons so that they're more rehabilitative. Primarily, we do that through legislative advocacy, but we also educate the public and tell stories. And you can go to our website, which is fam.org, F-A-M-M.org. You can read stories about people like Calvin. There are more stories like him, more Tennessee stories, and learn about these laws and how they're impacting families. And you can also learn about some of the bills that we're supporting. You can learn about the First Step Act and actually take action and ask your lawmakers to support the bill. You can do all of those things at our website.
Wonderful. Molly, I want to thank you so much for being here. She is, of course, the Vice President of Policy with Families Against Mandatory Minimums. Our producer is Greg Hill. This has been Dialogue, a production of WUOT News. I'm Victor Agreta.